From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America's new war on terror has a new message for the world. We are out for results. Don't get in the way. But rumblings from Europe say they're sick of America's steamroller unilateralism, and they're not going to take it anymore. This hour, America versus Europe, the showdown over calling the world's shots. First, the leader of an undercover team that tested security at the nation's airports said that the Federal Aviation Administration covered up shortcomings at U.S. airports for years. Now the Department of Transportation is investigating the claims. WBUR's Fred Tice has been following the story. Earlier, I asked Fred who the FAA whistleblower is.
Well, his name is Bogdan Dokovic. He has been working for the FAA for the better part of a decade, more than a decade, actually. He was once a federal air marshal. And then in 1995, he joined an elite team called the Red Team, which at that time had half a dozen or more members, that would travel around the country and the world testing security surreptitiously. FAA does regular tests that they announce and they warn people about. But then this Red Team is a check on all that, and they would go in and not announce them themselves and try to run real weapons through security,
right,
to see if they could get them aboard. He says that most of the time, nine times out of ten, they were able to get weapons aboard. They would then document those findings. And his complaint is that year after year, they would document those findings, and FAA management did nothing to close the loopholes in security.
Dokovic is scheduled to testify before Congress this week. He is saying that the FAA was criminally negligent, his words, in not closing those loopholes. Give us a sense of what he saw over the years that leads him to that very harsh conclusion.
He's still reluctant to get into specifics because there are some legal issues here. He has signed an oath not to reveal specific security vulnerabilities in our aviation system, either in the past or in the present. But in general, he talks about the inattentiveness of screeners, such that he was able to get weapons aboard aircraft. The airlines, he says, would not watch their gates so that employees would go through gates and somebody could sneak in behind them. And he witnessed this. And in fact, he and his colleagues on the Red Team did this repeatedly. Airplanes before September 11th were not locked at night. There were no searches of airplanes at the beginning of a work day. So these are the general problems that he says he pointed out.
And he was part of this Red Team, which was part of the FAA's internal organization for testing security. How long has he been doing this before 9/11?
He was doing it from 1995 on.
And were those tests going on right up until September 11th, 2001?
No, they stopped in 1998. And Bogdan says that they stopped because FAA management does not want to document.
They stopped just in his unit, or they stopped across FAA's jurisdiction entirely? They were no longer doing testing of their own security for 2 or 3 years before 9/11, is that right?
Just in that unit, which is the Washington-based unit that does the unannounced testing. Mm-hmm. They continue to do tests where they would say to screeners, you know, Tuesday, 10 a.m., we're going to put a gun through. Please watch for it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, those tests, screeners would usually pass with flying colors. 90% of the time, they would detect the test object that they had been warned to look for in the next 30 seconds. But when it was time to do realistic testing, he says 90% of the time, security failed.
Fred Tice, what was this agent's, Bogdan Dokovic, his sense of the context in which these lapses took place? Of course, it takes a certain kind of political resolve, in addition to institutional resolve, to really put down iron security. In the absence of the kind of shock that we had on 9/11, is this really the fault of the FAA, in his view, or was there simply not the cultural backdrop there, the political resolve to incur the expense and all the effort required to tighten security significantly?
He blames it on the culture at the FAA. Now, he says that what would happen is that agents would file reports, not just the Red Team agents, but field agents at major airports around the country when they detect security problems. And then the reports go to the legal department, the lawyers at the FAA negotiate with the lawyers at the airlines, the fees go down, and eventually the airline pays some sort of fee. He says that the problem is the initial security breach is never closed. That said, he never pointed to a specific problem that was actually exploited by the hijackers on September 11th. In other words, those hijackers are still believed by investigators to have walked aboard aircraft with knives of 4 inches or less in length, and that was legal at the time. Mm-hmm. So the hijackers apparently did not exploit any of the vulnerabilities to which he had been calling attention.
Do you have any sense from Dakovic that he is heartened by the new measures that have been taken since 9/11 to improve air travel security in the United States?
He definitely feels that security is better now. He himself, however, is quick to say that he would not fly, and he would advise anyone that he talks to not to fly.
Is there anticipation that criminal charges may actually be brought against FAA officials at some point?
Well, he uses those words, criminal negligence. I think we're going to have to see whether that's backed up by documentation. I have not heard anything from him that would indicate that at this point.
Mm-hmm. And when you hear his story, Fred Tice, does it seem to you that something was radically wrong with the FAA in terms of looking over security, despite the fact that what happened on September 11th was within its 4-inch knife limit, as you say? Was something fundamentally wrong there?
Absolutely, because his complaints are echoed on background by agents around the country who are reluctant to go on the record. This is something that other people face within the agency. They complain that they make these they find these security breaches and nothing is ever done about them because no one at the FAA has wanted to anger the airlines which they are supposed to regulate.
Fred Tice is a reporter with WBUR in Boston. In the new global climate, the Bush administration has adopted a new relationship with its allies. We're on a mission. Get out of our way. Of course, months ago, at the beginning, the administration used all the right catchwords to placate a group of nervous allies, words like coalition and teamwork and joint mission. But now, mission underway, America has taken the reins and is plowing ahead with its fight, its way, and world-weary, war-weary Europeans are starting to complain. There has never been a country with such overwhelming military might, cultural power, and economic wealth as the United States today. But European leaders are not entirely impressed. They've had it with American exceptionalism and American unilateralism. The bottom line seems to be the U.S. and Europe see the world and the world's crises in markedly different ways. Is the U.S. right to lock, load, and act on its own to set the world right? Is Europe just jealous and weak-willed, or is it time for the U.S. to stop and listen? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us tonight from Washington is Rupert Cornwall. He's Washington correspondent for Britain's daily newspaper, The Independent. Good evening and welcome, Rupert Cornwall.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. Rupert Cornwall, act as an interpreter for us here for a minute, if you would. What's going wrong in this relationship?
Well, I'll try and explain that from a European perspective, though I lack the one part of the perspective, which is that I'm on this side of the Atlantic and not the other.
But you're not sitting in the face of the full fury on the other
exactly.
side.
Exactly. But I went back to London about a month ago and did get a blast of the full fury.
And it is furious now, isn't it?
In certain quarters, yes. I mean, there's always been a traditional, should we say, anti-American, left-wing intelligentsia in Europe. But the feelings of unease that's always had have spread, I think, pretty widely through populations and governments as well.
So what's going on?
Well, I think there's three things, really. I mean, this is from the way the Europeans see it. There's basically three complaints they have against America. The first one is unilateralism. They thought in the immediate aftermath of September the 11th that America had changed its ways. As you say, it was talking of coalition and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And they thought that September the 11th had been a kind of giant lesson that they had to basically rejoin the world, as it were. Mm-hmm. The second complaint is one of simplism. That's to say, and particularly that's come up with the axis of evil notion coined by President Bush. Europeans say the problems posed by Iraq and Iran and North Korea are completely different, and also to single them out like this and back them into a corner as naughty boys actually could make the problem worse, and I think that's happened in the case of Iran particularly mm-hmm. as well. Now, the third one is this thing you touched on in your introduction, mm-hmm. which is what I think Newt Gingrich used to call it, the doctrine of American exceptionalism. That's to say that America was a country with a special mission, a special origin, that somehow distinguished it and made it better than other countries, that made it the last best hope of humanity, if you like. This was Ronald Reagan's shining city on a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And this gives the Americans in this crusade a sense of great self-righteousness, that they are best, that they know best, and this is their destiny. And what makes it all even worse, if you like, seen from a European perspective, is that this time the Americans have gone into a crisis like this with a really colossal sense of grievance and vengeance after September the 11th. Had there not been that, perhaps they might have been more inclined to listen to allies. As it is, they feel we've got something to avenge, and so the problem is particularly acute.
Rupert Cornwell, it must be, if Europeans imagined that after 9/11 the United States would join hands with the rest of the world and look toward a new multilateralism, they must really be shocked. That's not what's happened, obviously. How do Europeans see what's transpired since 9/11 in terms of the American response?
Well, I think they were very sympathetic to begin with. The first part of the military campaign as well, people thought that really there was no alternative to a military answer. Most people, there were some, of course, who said absolutely not. But once the evidence was presented that al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, it was virtually as one with the Taliban regime, most people understood that America legitimately had to do something.
Mm-hmm.
But over the weeks and the months, the attitudes have changed. First of all, September the 11th itself has sort of faded from the European psyche. It was, after all, an American tragedy, an American disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Second, you've had all the problems of collateral damage, which have worried people a lot. And there seems to be really no sympathy, no great sense of admission from the Americans on it. The Pentagon just says, well, we regret this, but it still goes on bombing and there's still cases reported. And the third thing is the axis of evil again, the way the Americans, not content with having basically dispatched the Taliban in Afghanistan, are now lining up apparently other countries as targets and are basically kind of high-handedly grading other countries on the basis of their response to terrorism mm-hmm. and their sympathy with Americans.
Mm-hmm. So what, by your lights, Rupert Cornwell, is the fundamental divergence of views here? How do Europe and the U.S. see the world differently that leads to these different attitudes and postures?
Well, I think it's a matter of degree, really. In the case of terrorism, the Europeans instinctively look to the root causes of it. Europeans remember, too, this is also a very important factor. Terrorism has been part of the background music in Europe for decades. In Britain, we've had the IRA, the Spain, there's been the Basques, the Italian, okay. German terrorists, and so on. For America, September the 11th was an enormous, enormous shock. And in Europe, the tendency has been to look for and to try and reach for the causes of terrorism, which most people would agree lie in poverty and repressive regimes, and also, of course, the complete and total impasse between Israel and the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
The sense in Europe is that America really ignores all of this and has just made this blind Manichaean distinction between good and evil and is just out to get the bad guys.
All right, so you're sitting somewhere mid-Atlantic in your view.
Exactly, yes.
What is your view, Rupert Cornwell? Who's got it right?
I think there's right on both sides, I'm afraid, and I think the Americans have behaved a little bit simplistically in this. There is a Manichaeism which simply isn't justified by events. And also, to carry the war on like this, I think, could be extremely destabilizing and disturbing for international stability. On the other hand, there is, without a doubt, in the European reaction, an element of jealousy.
Mm.
Never has a country been as relatively all-powerful as the U.S. Never, never, never in 1,000 years.
But you said that recently you wrote in The Independent about this anti-Americanism in Europe and made the mistake of including your email address, and you got an earful from American readers.
I got an earful from Americans, which was very interesting. And I must say I'm very glad I didn't include the email address, because you do get the Vox Populi response. And I should think 50% of the emails I had from Americans were saying, well, just to hell with you Europeans. We rescued you twice in world wars, and this is what we get for it. Thank you very much.
and no bones about it.
Rupert
Cornwell, we've got to take a break, and we know we have to let you go. Rupert Cornwell is Washington correspondent for Britain's The Independent newspaper. Rupert, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're talking about American unilateralism post 9/11, but it's not just the war on terror anymore. It's just about everything the Bush administration touches. What do you think? Is the White House? Is Washington right to say we've identified the problem and we're going after it alone if necessary? Is the U.S. right to take charge and go it alone in a troubled world? Are you comfortable with Washington's my way or the highway view of the world in the year 2002? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American unilateralism. It is blossoming day by day, week by week, as George W. Bush and his administration appear to decide that the world may dither, but the United States cannot. It's a troubled world, and Washington gives every indication that it's going to go it alone in solving what it sees as the world's problems. Can America afford to wait for a global consensus, even a consensus of its allies, or does it have to be ready to go it alone? What's more likely to be to effectively address acute global problems today, American cooperation in group efforts or American readiness to cut through the talk and act alone, to act unilaterally? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined now from London by William Wallace. He's professor of international relations at the European Institute. Good evening and welcome, William Wallace.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being with us. And we're joined from Washington, D.C. by William Taylor. He's a retired Army colonel, served in Germany, Korea, and Vietnam. He's now a distinguished alumnus at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Good evening and welcome, William Taylor.
I'm here.
Good to have you. William Wallace, in London first, please give us the picture from the view in London. What is the fundamental complaint of the European community now with the United States is acting in relationship to its power and the world?
I'm not sure it's a complaint so much now. It's puzzlement, it's general confusion, because what we are getting is a lot of different messages from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last few weeks, they have got increasingly worrying. We've been told that the United States has now set up an Institute for Strategic Influence, which is going to feed misinformation to other countries, presumably including the European allies. We've been told that the United States is going to invade Iraq. But we've also been told, reading my Herald Tribune yesterday, that the United States can't actually invade Iraq for several months or a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting a range of confusing messages. We're also getting visitors, congressmen, people from the administration, who are saying, in effect, in your face, this is what we're going to do. We don't care about you. And what a lot of us have to say is, simply isn't in America's interest. And if I just give you one example, a good friend from Washington, who was actually in the last administration, saying to me, you know, we didn't see anything wrong with what we're doing in Guantanamo Bay. And a number of us were saying, you're going to have special forces out there, not in uniform. And you're going to need international law. It's not just a question of upsetting us. It's also that the United States seems to us at the moment to be neglecting its own long-term interests in a patriotic fervor of beating the world.
But William Wallace, you see that the counterview is coming out without apology from Washington and the Washington Circle these days. In the Wall Street Journal today, former CIA head James Woolsey has a very, let's say, forthright column that essentially calls the Europeans a bunch of sissies. He said it's like the movie High Noon. America is Gary Cooper. We're standing up to do the right thing. Europe are a bunch of, you know, nattering nabobs, never willing to step up and do the necessary hard work. Is this delusional?
Sadly, it is. I'm sitting with the article in front of me, and indeed, several of us have circulated it around policymakers in London. It's very sad. The over-influence of cinema on U.S. foreign policy is one of the things that worries a lot of people in Europe. The new film, Black Hawk Down, which absurdly oversimplifies and misrepresents
the Somali situation, Mogadishu.
Somalia is another case in point. One has to say, James Woolsey obviously doesn't remember or even know what High Noon was about, which was the problem of McCarthyism in the United States. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about defeating evildoers from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And the oversimplification that Europeans worry about is this identification of an axis of evil out there which the Americans can defeat. We've learned bitterly over the last 30 years that you can't defeat terrorism simply through military means. Mm-hmm. You also have to deal with some of the causes. We're going to have to stick it out probably for 10 years in Afghanistan. One of the problems of Afghanistan is that the United States walked away in 1989 and didn't stay to make sure that once the Soviet Union left, a viable Afghan society and economy mm-hmm. was recreated. So mm-hmm. we have a lot of concerns about the consistency, coherence of U.S. foreign policy.
William Wallace, we're awfully glad you're with us. If this is the British view, one can only imagine what must be coming out of France and Germany. William Taylor, what do you hear in this analysis? Rupert Cornwell with The Independent was on earlier. He's written that Europe and the United States now see the world in profoundly different ways. So who's not seeing straight, William Taylor? What's up here?
Number one, it will work out. Number two, William Wallace to say, we have to deal with the causes of terrorism. Mm-hmm. How nice. Let the EU do it. Let the U.S. do it. Let anybody else do it. Get off the simplistic junk. The problem right now is there is terrorism mm-hmm. around the world.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be challenged. I guess we all agree. Almost everyone's come on that line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who does it? How do we do it? Who takes the lead? Well, the United States says we will take the lead. And President George Bush, the guy that dream calls, simplistic. And Chris Patton says we have to avoid absolutist and simplistic positions.
Mm.
They don't have any lead. They have critiques. Well, somebody has to take the lead, and the United States has done it.
William Taylor, what about the perspective that, very good for the United States to go after the overt perpetrators of terrorism, but there are underlying causes here that will require a joint effort to solve? Do you see merit in that?
Of course there is. And let the EU take the lead in that. Let them pour massive amounts.
We do. We pay.
William Wallace,
you don't pay close to what the U.S. pays, and you know it.
Pay in what terms, William Taylor?
Your point is simplistic, is what I'm telling you. If you're going to go after it, then sink something into it. And by the way, my friend, you don't sink anything. You or EU doesn't sink anything into defense spending to go out and do something about it, as a matter of fact.
Well, We have military budgets and we have foreign aid budgets. All right.
Hold off. The U.S. defense budget is more than the combined budget of 12 of NATO's other 18 members. Do you know that?
Yes, I'm sure that we do. William Taylor, stand by for a moment. William Wallace, what about this particular point? The EU tend to spend a higher proportion of GDP on foreign aid. The United States obviously spends far more on military. What are the consequences? What's the meaning of that disparity?
I think both sides are out of whack. I mean, let's put the figures down straight. If you look at the UN peacekeeping budget, EU member states pay 55% of that. If you look at the UN general budget, EU member states pay 40% of that. That's a huge amount more than the United States does. US foreign assistance has been going down. The United States goes into Afghanistan, and the question of who's going to stay and reconstruct the country is still open. And all these messages we hear from Condi Rice and everyone else that the United States is not into nation building implies that the United States comes in, does the rough stuff, and then leaves and let others clear up the mess.
Is that a reasonable division of labor or not?
No, I think I have no question, and the British government is pushing for the Europeans to do more on defense and to put more of our defense effort together.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us also think, and we've read the Pentagon studies, and we're very sorry that Donald Rumsfeld hasn't managed it, that the United States is actually spending too much on defense at the present moment because some of it's being spent extremely inefficiently. Yeah. We understood that Donald Rumsfeld was going to come in and push some necessary reforms through the Pentagon. Mm. It doesn't seem to us very sensible. You know, what the United States is now doing is simply increasing the defense budget, including some rather unnecessary weapons, as well as the new things that need doing to cope with this situation. Throwing money at defense and refusing to invest money in economic and social development that creates more stable states, which
we
means
are
you
off
get at
on
some
the,
of the
wrong track. This thing is heading in totally the wrong direction.
What's on the wrong track, William Taylor?
The wrong track is there a war against terrorism?
No. Let's be quite clear.
There you go.
You
got your answer, my friend. Now you explain this, buddy.
William Taylor, we cannot miss the note of bitterness in your voice. Are you suggesting in that, are you feeling in that, that the Europeans are actively or cynically ducking some responsibility here?
Yes.
And why do you think they would do that?
Because you do not have to do anything. You do not have to invest in your defense budgets. You do not have to go invest in Afghanistan or wherever the war on terrorism has to go. You can sit back and you can tripe. You can do your thing. And you don't know a thing about Americans. You don't know a thing about American history. You don't know why Americans go to war, don't go to war. By the way, you might say Americans were unilateralists when in 1914 to 17, you had to fight a war against the Germans, and we didn't come in, but we came in and saved Europe. You might fight that Americans were unilateralists when we didn't come in 1938, when Hitler was moving across Europe, and we stayed out until we got stabbed in the back in Pearl Harbor. Hmm. You might try that. Hey, buddy. Get it straight.
William Taylor, William Wallace, we don't want immensely,
and you've given us a perfect example of the message that Americans are now giving the Europeans. Mm,
indeed.
What's wrong with that?
I do actually know. I spent some time teaching American politics at Cornell.
Two Williams, I'm going to have to ask you to stand by. We hear the gap opening up here, and my goodness, it's for real. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation as well. Let's bring them in if we may. Peter is on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, I'm not sure there is as wide a gap because there are a great many Europeans, I think, who secretly, and some of them openly, admire what America is doing, do not agree with their elites, and even some of those elites are in open agreement. You had on as a representative Englishman someone from the Independent.
Yes.
But you might have had Charles Moore of the Telegraph, for example.
A more conservative publication.
And one that has had an admiring interview in the last day or two with Rumsfeld. You might have noted that in Italy, the book by the former left-wing journalist Oriana Fallaci, La Rabbia e l'Orgoglio, The Anger and Pride, has sold in the last 2 months 800,000 copies.
And what's the implication of that, Peter?
Well, that book is a paean of praise to America and a denunciation by this former left-wing interviewer of Khomeini and Arafat and Castro,
Fallaci,
of American resistance to evil, of the fact that she deplores what she sees as the Islamic migration and takeover of her own country, Italy, and says, are we going to, you know, is my country, the country of Leonardo and Raffaello, Michelangelo, to be given over to the burqa and hador? And she has struck a chord with a great many Italians.
Right. Peter, hang on. I want to put this to William Wallace. William Wallace, it's a bit unfair to ask you to speak for all of Europe, but we've got you tonight. So what about Peter's point, his assertion that, in fact, behind the elite of European leadership, there is widespread sympathy among Europeans?
That's not what the opinion polls are showing. And we can only take what the opinion polls are showing. I think he's suggesting that there are quite a lot of Europeans who are as anti-Islamic as some popular opinion is in the United States. And that's certainly true in some areas.
It depends
which particular Islamic population you've got. There are about 15 million Muslims living in Europe, and most of them extremely peaceful. So all I can say is I don't see the evidence from the opinion polls I've seen to support what he said.
Let's take another call. Peter, thank you for yours. Troy is on the line. Welcome, Troy. You're on the air.
How you guys doing? I just wanted to call basically just to kind of speak with, I think, one of your experts, your first callers, in that the press and the academic elite have, you know, seized, and the European elite have seized on an opportunity to criticize the Bush administration as being overly simplistic in their depiction of North Korea, Iraq, and Iran as an acts of evil. Well, the reality of the situation is that, you know, North Korea, Iraq, and Iran have been trying their best to develop nuclear weapons of mass destruction, biological, and chemical. And no one's been doing anything about it for years. There's been a lot of papers written. The U.S., you know, through Clinton's bungled foreign policy there, which, you know, he did the best he could, but he didn't have a mandate from the people that George Bush does now.
Right, Troy, I think we've got your point, and your phone's breaking up a little bit. Let me put this to William Taylor. William Taylor, do you think that Bush has been unfairly pummeled for describing the axis of evil and going after it?
I have come out in writing and in public against the axis of evil speech. I don't think he should have done it.
So you agree it's simplistic?
I'm fiercely proud of President Bush and his National Security Council team. I understand what they're doing. That was a mistake. But let me tell you something. Those who criticize American foreign policy right now have not read the history of Americans. We got wounded badly in World War One. We hung out. We stayed out of World War One from 1914 to 1918.
But William Taylor, is it possible? We got your history on that, and we acknowledge and salute it. There's no question about it. But the question that does come up, I guess, is it possible that this is a different kind of conflict that that needs a different kind of response?
Of course it is. And we've been wounded again. And when nobody else will take the leadership except CARP, which many of the EU are doing, in reply. Americans think they are on a track. We've been wounded badly. And if nobody's going to be on with us, get off it.
William Wallace, your thoughts?
That's American.
We know a lot about American history.
That's American. If you don't like it,
and it simply isn't true to say that we don't understand the American perspective. Secondly, we've been dealing with terrorism for 30 years. And we've learned painfully, particularly the British, dealing with the IRA. And the IRA was an international terrorist movement with getting its arms from Czechoslovakia via Libya, getting a lot of money from the United States. And we've learned that you simply have to stay the course. You have to deal militarily, but also politically. And you have to deal with some of the underlying causes. That's part of what we're saying to the United States, where we worry. And I think we worry more about the rhetoric of the administration at the moment than what the administration's actually done.
William Taylor,
particularly about the nationalistic tone which comes out of the United States.
William Taylor, I want to put, we've just got 30 seconds left before the break. William Taylor, your thoughts there? Nationalistic tone?
Obviously, the problems of the IRA have been solved because there's such great leadership behind that. Let me tell you something. There is a big challenge here. There is American history. If you don't want to read it, don't read it.
I've read a lot of it.
But we are simply Americans going to do again what we did in 1898, 1917, 1941, and you got us whether you like it or not. And if you don't like it, spend more money on defense.
Well, we hear you loud and clear, William.
Take the lead.
William Taylor is distinguished alumnus at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. William Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
This is Tom Ashbrook with On Point. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American unilateralism. It's the message coming out of Washington, out of the Bush White House. It's unmistakable abroad. We're joined tonight by William Wallace. He's professor of international relations at the European Institute. He's joining us from London. He's author of Policymaking in the European Union. What do you think? Are you comfortable with Washington's my way or the highway stand toward the world? Is American unilateralism now the only way to go? Is multilateral global action a recipe for paralysis, or is it the only way to act in the global village? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Joachim is calling from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Good evening. Welcome, Joachim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually sort of a little bit concerned because it seems like that after 9/11, there was sort of a real increase in global understanding and people, like actually the whole world kind of, I think, was proud about...
After September 11th.
Proud about how the Americans behaved, and there was a lot of, you know, grace and a lot of humility in their behavior. And so now the tide is completely turned again, and I think there was like a sort of a moment of global... the potential for global understanding at some point. I think what I'm sort of like concerned with is that unilateralism that you're talking about affects the rest of the world. Like when we here have a certain lifestyle and actually are the biggest polluters in the world.
Yeah, Joachim, I'm terribly sorry, but you're breaking up on us. We're going to have to take that right there, William Wallace. You hear the caller saying that he's disappointed with the trend line since the immediate aftermath of 9/11, that there was a kind of grace and shared global understanding at that moment that appears to have been lost. Do you share that view?
I do. And I think part of the problem has been it's been the language as much as the actions of American foreign policy that have been damaging. The Bush administration handled the weeks after September the 11th very well, very carefully, and very successfully. And it did build a coalition. The speed, unexpected speed with which the Taliban regime collapsed has led to what seems to many of us to be an air of triumphalism in the United States and a reversal to the sort of in-your-face, this is what we're going to do, put up with it or go away style, which we had from some parts of the Bush administration in the first half of the year. Now, haven't done very much that's different yet, or the rhetoric on Iraq and on North Korea, or when President Bush went to Korea, he climbed back from what he'd said about the axis of evil. But the style in which Americans are now talking to their allies, whom you're going to go on needing as partners on a whole host of other matters, is extremely damaging.
William Wallace, we heard earlier in William Taylor's comments, and you didn't have a chance to reply, so let me give it to you now, but this assertion that repeatedly throughout at least 20th century history, Europe has underestimated threats and then relied on the United States to come in and save the world. And I guess you could say it's more than an assertion, but do you have any niggling concern that that may be playing out here again this time? Is it possible that Europe, for whatever reason, is less prone to act and the United States is on the right course, or are you confident that that's just not the reality here?
I mean, there are all sorts of different realities.
Yes.
William Taylor was giving a particular myth of American history. The Americans come in and they go out again. And, of course, one of the aspects of American history has been this sense that the United States goes in and then goes home as soon as the war is over.
But it feels to Americans like more than myth that victory ensued from American involvement in two world wars, and that's a point of pride.
It's a point of entirely justifiable pride. And the United States, after World War II, did stay and help to rebuild societies, economies, states across Western Europe. Immensely valuable. We have not at all forgotten it. It's one of the things I teach regularly to all of my European students every year. What worries us about the current American gung-ho attitude is, first of all, that it stresses military force more than anything else. Secondly, it doesn't really come to terms with the complex politics of the Middle East or West Asia. That in all of this rhetoric, we never hear anything about American energy dependence, nor do we hear anything about the Arab-Israeli dispute.
Part
of the picture.
15, 20 years ago, Ronald Reagan talked about the evil empire, the Soviet Union, and said, tear down that wall. And he was mocked by some Europeans, and it was said that this was simplistic. Is it possible that once again a simple, if you will, American view of the world might be an effective one? Or do you think that's just out to lunch this time?
I think it is out to lunch. The world is not that simple. And the Soviet Union did not collapse because Ronald Reagan called it an evil empire. The Soviet Union collapsed because it had some fundamental problems. And once Gorbachev attempted to reform it, it fell apart. It had been run by old men for far too long. The picture that when Reagan stood up to the Soviet Union collapsed is, I know, very popular in the United States at the present moment. That's also a rather simple picture.
Hmm. Giuseppe is on the line. Welcome, Giuseppe. You're on the air.
Hello. I'd like to make a little point here. I am Italian, and I live in the United States, more or less like Oriana Fallaci, which was mentioned.
Yes.
I do share with Oriana the great respect and admiration for the United States, and I believe that without the United States, as she says, we would probably speak German in Italy right now, or maybe Russian.
So how do you feel about the American posture toward the world today?
I would say that America has a great chance to be the leader that it deserves to be, but at the same time, I believe should take into account the opportunity to be friend with the right people. When I mean that, I like to say, like, there are some countries that America can focus to be closer and build the coalition.
Do you mean traditional European allies America would be closer with, or others?
I would say traditional European allies, of course, and also trying to extend this opportunity of being friends with the United States with some of the countries, let's say, that are promoting human rights and being more towards democracy.
Such as
Bangladesh, let's say.
Bangladesh, to bring them into the American orbit. Giuseppe, thank you for your call. William Wallace, is the United States missing an opportunity here to actually bring in stronger global support with different rhetoric and a bit softened face to the world?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, as I was saying before, I think the determination for the United States not to be involved in reconstructing states, only to be concerned with the military force, and the idea that terrorism is something which you just fight with military means, that's not the nature of terrorism. The terrorists don't stand and fight. They appear out of the darkness, and they disappear back into the darkness, and you have to deal with their popular support in the countries through which they operate. That's long-term, very delicate stuff. Terrorism is not like fighting conventional war. So the United States certainly needs to remember a different bit of its history, how well the United States did in the years after World War II in helping to construct stable democracies across shattered Western Europe and East Asia, tremendous work they did in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and to get back to doing that again.
But your description of the ambiguity that's marbled through terrorism sounds much more like a European dish than an American one, in a way, doesn't it?
Yes, but it's something that the Americans have to understand. It is the biggest concern about that the Europeans have about the United States now is that the United States does want to ride in, fire, and then ride out again. That will still leave a lot of these problems unsolved. And I have to say that Europeans have the gravest of doubts about American understanding of the complex politics of the Middle East.
What are you speaking of in particular?
The way in which the United States has demonized Iran. Iran is a country coming out of revolution in which there are different factions, some relatively pro-Western and moderate, some a great deal more conservative Islamic. We need to encourage the moderates. The United States, which has supported a deeply reactionary regime in Saudi Arabia because of its heavy dependence on energy, and now finds that it has been supporting in many ways the wrong side. The United States, which will not address the problem of the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is part of what drives people on the Arab street to be anti-American. All of those matters need to be considered together, and they can't be resolved simply by bombing Iraq and then going home and leaving a shattered Iraq as a real problem for the whole of the region.
But it sounds like the U.S. may do that. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very distressed that our government is not listening to our allies, our historical allies in Europe, and I wish that President Bush would follow his own policy that he advocated in his debate on foreign policy with Al Gore when he advocated humility in foreign policy.
Hmm. What do you fear Washington is missing in not listening to Europe, John?
Well, I think the European experience with terrorism and dealing with many of the problems that we are experiencing firsthand for the first time, we have something to learn from their experience. And I think to dismiss that, first of all, it can sour our relationship, but also it could lead to less effective policies.
But is there such a thing as a clear and present danger that the Europeans may just be not in the mood to address? Is there some kind of old-fashioned American readiness to stand up and kick it or roll, as George Bush says, that speaks to you, John, or not at all?
I certainly think that we have to be taking action, but I think that the idea that we should not be listening to our allies and just telling them to get with our program is neither humble nor prudent.
Mm-hmm. John, thanks very much for your call. William Wallace, is it possible for Europe and the United States to really be dance partners now with this enormous American military budget and American military? Is it just so outsized that we can no longer really work with Europe in the traditional NATO way?
Well, military power is not the only thing in the world. We also have a highly intense economic relationship,
mm-hmm.
and that requires some hard bargaining as well. It requires a very trustful, continuing relationship. We have to be extremely careful that all this over-military rhetoric mm-hmm. doesn't damage that close relationship. Huge U.S. foreign investment in Europe, huge European foreign investment in the United States. So the military dimension is not the only one. But if I can comment on the question, is there a clear and present danger that the United States is the only one that sees, the threat of terrorism is not the same as the threat of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
It's a qualitatively different sort of threat, mm-hmm. and it requires a qualitatively different sort of answer.
Mm-hmm.
And the United States just has to see that. You can't send aircraft carriers against a terrorist threat. You can collapse the Taliban regime, but if that merely disperses terrorists around a large number of weak states around the world, that's not going to resolve your problem.
Mm, point taken. Graham is on the line. Welcome, Graham. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I'd like to make 2 points. The first point is a response to a previous caller who said that in Europe there are many Europeans who secretly support the Bush's policy.
Yes.
My point would be I'm a British person living in America.
All right.
For the past few years, and I've met over the past few months many Americans who don't support Bush's policy, who secretly don't support it, but you never hear them. You never hear them on the media. They seem to be somehow marginalized. You only seem to hear one point of view.
Do you think they're censored, Graham, or is it something else?
I don't know. Maybe it's some sort of self-censorship with the media. I mean, I would say your own program is an honorable partial exception to this. But
partial?
You never hear. For example, why don't you have Noam Chomsky on your show or someone with his point of view? I mean, he's...
You just wait, Graham. You just wait. Graham, we're running out of time, so I've got to let you go, but we appreciate your point.
Okay.
William Wallace, we've just got a minute before we're out of time here. What do you think the consequences of this divergent view of the world may be, if not tended to?
I hope that we're not going to get into an unnecessary row in which anti-Europeanism in the United States it clashes with anti-Americanism in Europe. It's very important we don't get into sort of hostile emotions. We need our friends in Congress. We need, I agree, our friends in the American media.
But if you don't get that, what then?
To the Bush administration, cool it. No, remember what Bush said as a candidate about the need for a relative humility in American foreign policy. The in-your-face arrogance that we're currently hearing is not in America's long-term interest.
William Wallace is professor of international relations at the European Institute. He's joined us from London. He's author of Policymaking in the European Union. Thanks so much for being with us tonight, William Wallace.
Pleasure.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're